The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be.
To Unfiltered on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your co-host, Aaron Patrick, and we're doing a little pre-record. Sans my co-host, Brian DeMarco, who is at the beach today, but had an opportunity to do a show before Tuesday as a pre-record with a winemaker who is a returning guest on the studio's show. This is Grant Phelps. Welcome, Grant.
Thanks, Aaron. Yeah. Glad to be back.
Make yourself comfortable. Bring your little microphone closer to you so you don't have to work so hard. It is Sunday after all.
It's a good point.
Yeah. So Grant was here almost, one of the first guests on my wine program At the Root of It. And since then, we've adapted it a bit. It's now called and I have a co-host who you meet him on Tuesday. Tuesday is the annual Wines of Chile tasting, so I guess that's what brings you here in New York this week.
Well, I'm here for a variety of reasons. I want us to drink as much beer as possible. The other reason is to, yes, go to the annual Wines of Chile tasting on Tuesday, and then tomorrow, Monday, we're doing the launch of Casas del Bosque in the New York market. We've just started the new importer here with Andrew Bell of Wine Symphony, so... Mm-hmm. We're kicking it all off, so our wines are finally going to be available in New York. So
yeah,
we're pretty excited.
Yeah, it's the big market.
It's a big market. New Yorkers love their wine, and also it gives me a great excuse to come to New York a couple of times a year, which
exactly.
is not necessarily great for my liver, but you know it does. I do have a good time, and
yes.
we get to hang out, so
exactly.
that's nice. Aaron.
Now, Casas del Bosque is in the Casablanca Valley, and when you were here before and working as a winemaker for several years, was about 10 years in Chile prior to Casas del Bosque? You were at Viuminet.
Yeah, I was with Viuminet for 7 years.
Okay.
I did a couple of vintages before that, but I've been living full-time in Chile for 9 years now. I just finished my 11th harvest in Chile.
Congratulations.
Last week, got the last grapes picked straight on a plane to New York. That's
wow.
the way it works.
Wow. No sleep.
No sleep. Yeah. Not in New York. There isn't anyway.
So, Casas del Bosque is about how far from Colchagua, where you were prior to working with Casas del Bosque?
Yeah, I mean, Colchagua is a little bit further down south. It's Colchagua is probably a little bit more comparable to Napa, maybe, to put it in American sort of context.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hotter valley, so it's very much sort of specialized in Cab Sav, Syrah, Carmenere. And then with the move up to Casas del Bosque, I mean, now I'm much closer to the coast. Casablanca is basically due west from Santiago, the capital.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So Colchagua is about 200 kilometers or about 120 miles south
sure.
of Santiago, whereas Casablanca is basically at the same level of Santiago, just going straight out towards the coast. So in a straight line from Santiago, it's about 60 miles, more
mm-hmm.
or less. It's
mm-hmm.
about an hour's driving from the big smoke.
And when did Casas del Bosque, when was it founded?
Well, Casablanca is a really interesting valley, actually, within the Chilean context.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chile's been making wine for close to 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a slight exaggeration. 400 years. I'll just ratchet that down a notch. My embellishments are getting better, aren't they? So basically, yeah, 400 years of wine history in Chile. It's always traditionally been concentrated further south in the hotter areas. Casablanca virtually had no agriculture until the mid-1980s because there was no groundwater. It's one of the few valleys which has no river
mm-hmm.
running through it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why traditionally there's been no agriculture there, just because of the lack of water. The first vineyards were planted in the mid-80s at an experimental level by one of the universities in Chile, and the first water they found was about 450 feet down. So today that's continues to be the case. All of the vineyards in Casablanca are watered from deep, deep well water.
Hmm.
So it's quite unusual in that respect. And the first commercial production of grapes started in 1989. Casas del Bosque, the winery I'm working for now, was founded in 1993. We're in the sort of the coolest part of the valley. It's the part that's closest to the ocean. We're only about 30 miles, mm-hmm. or a little bit less, about 25 miles in a straight line from the Pacific. So we're very, very close.
That is interesting. So you would then be considered a pioneering sort of wine region, as well as potentially a winery who was there right in the beginning when this was all sort of going down.
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, the first winery was planted in the hotter end of the valley, which is the part closest to Santiago. We were the first to be in the really sort of frost-prone, foggy, really cool part of the valley. And yeah, I mean, Casablanca was the first cool climate region in Chile. I mean, it's been followed since then by newer regions like Lleida, San Antonio. You've mm-hmm. got Elqui and Limarí, which have parts close to the ocean. And even Colchagua now is starting to develop vineyards much closer to the ocean than has been the case sort of traditionally.
Yeah.
So definitely the cool climate thing is really starting to take off in Chile. You know, I think it's really exciting, especially seeing what's happening with, you know, the whites have been consistently very, very good for the last 10 or 15 years. But the reds have really only just started to come online, especially the Syrah, and that's what I think is starting to generate a lot of buzz in the wine press, especially up here in North America. The Syrahs, I mean, it's a very different style of Syrah, you know, being very, very cool climate, you know, good natural acidity. The wines are much more sort of floral, so you're seeing a lot of lavender and kind of violet notes coming through in the wine. It's just a very, very fresh style of Syrah. I mean, we're right on the limit of where we can get Syrah ripe. So it's one of those things where we're picking at the last possible moment. And I mean, we just finished picking the Syrah, like I said, last week. And, you know, and the alcohols are very, very low. I mean, we're talking 12.5 to 13.5 degrees alcohol.
That's great. So they have a nice ripeness, but not overly ripe, and have a good acidity as well.
Well, it's one of those things where it's just really long hanging time in the vineyard. You know, it's... You know, you're out there until the end of May. I mean, if you compare it with Colchagua, where most of the Syrah is picked around the 15th of April, I mean, it's over a month earlier.
Wow.
And you're talking alcohols in the 14.5 to 15.5 range, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, we're picking over a month later and we're picking the grapes with 2 or 3 degrees less alcohol. It's quite a big difference.
Yeah, and then you have the cool climate nights to really keep that possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly cold where we are. I mean, just as an example, in January... I was looking at the temperature data for the whole month in our vineyard, and we got up to the maximum recorded temperature was about 30.4 degrees, so it's about 90 Fahrenheit. That was the hottest minute of recorded temperature, if you like, for the whole month. And then the lowest temperature was 1 degree Celsius, so about 33 Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
So we're almost getting frosts in the hottest month of the year.
Quite a range, yeah.
It is a really tricky aspect to making wine where we are, because there's a lot of frost risk. And, for example, last growing season we have a lot of big windmills.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to turn them on 22 different nights. And every hour that we run each tower costs $100 just for the natural gas. They'll run on natural gas.
Uh-huh. So those are the things that people don't necessarily think about when they think about, you know, what's in the cost of a bottle, all those
factors. Exactly. It's all of those little things. As well with us, you know, as going back to the Syrah example, we have to crop our Syrah at 4 tons a hectare, which is... But I always have this problem with acres and hectares.
I know, we all do.
It's like 1.5 tons an acre, more or less.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty low, and whereas in Colchagua, like I was saying, you pick way earlier, you can also crop much higher, so you can get away with 5 tons an acre there and still make really nice wine. So, you know, it does add to the cost, you know, having to crop it 2 or 3 times less, and also just all the added complications of frost management and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, it does add to the price of your bottle of wine.
Of course, yeah. So how many different wineries then are you, you know... are around in the region, and is there sort of a coalition or organization where it bonds all of them together, or is it kind of one man on its own?
No, there is a valley kind of body. It's the association of the wineries in Casablanca and the vineyards as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that we do have a kind of an organization that represents us. There's a lot of vineyards in Casablanca. A lot of the grapes go elsewhere. I mean, like I was saying before, it's a new area.
Yeah.
A lot of the wineries that planted in Casablanca are very historic wineries. Have been around for a long time, and they're established in more traditional areas,
mm-hmm.
places like Maipo and Colchagua, etc. You know, even when I was with Viuminent, we're picking most of our white grapes in Casablanca and trucking them down to the winery.
Sure, yeah.
So still a lot of the grapes leave the valley to be vinified,
mm-hmm.
but within the valley we've got about, I think about 10 or 15 different wineries.
So, yeah, still pretty small, though, yeah.
It's not a lot of wineries compared with the amount of area under vine in the valley, because there's a lot of vineyards in Casablanca.
And you have mentioned this in conversations before, that not a huge population of Chile actually consumes the wine that is made in that country. So, in regards to Casablanca and the sort of cool climate designation, do you find that the marketing for that your wines are trying to appeal to people who are thinking more of a European style, finishing dry, sort of cooler climate, northern Italy, northern France, a drier finish, as opposed to perhaps wines that are, you know, attributed to riper fruit, more oak, maybe fuller alcohol that tend to come from South America?
I mean, it's still a new world area, so I think people logically tend to compare us. I mean, Casablanca is very well known, for example, for Sauvignon Blanc. It was the first, like I said, cool climate region in Chile, so it was the first region to really start to produce vibrant, racy, you know, acidic Sauvignon Blancs. So that's kind of, I guess, been the real thing on which Casablanca has hung its hat.
Yeah, it's what you do well.
It's what we do well. There's a lot of Sauvignon in the valley. I think for me it's... I think you look globally, I think Casablanca Sauvignon Blanc has a real style, a real personality to it. I think it stands up really well against everything else. The logical comparison, I think, for a lot of people is New Zealand, South Africa at the moment, being the other kind of New World areas which are doing a lot of Sauvignon and doing it well.
Yeah.
But like I was saying, I think we have our own style. The Sauvignons, you know, whereas New Zealand, everyone talks about the whole the cat's pee on a gooseberry bush kind of descriptor, you know,
yes.
Very herbaceous, bordering on vegetal kind of styles of Sauvignon, a lot of asparagus, all those kind of characters coming through. Where we are, it's we don't get that green herbal kind of note.
No, it's more like lime zest and citrus.
Exactly,
and,
it's much more citric, which I think is very, very attractive. Mm-hmm. You know, being a Kiwi, I was kind of breastfed Sauvignon Blanc, you know, as a child, and so I kind of can't stand New Zealand Sauvignon. No, that's not fair. I mean, I do like New Zealand Sauvignon. I do like New Zealand Sauvignon, but I think it's nice to go elsewhere. And, you know, as a New Zealand winemaker, you tend to get a bit bored making Sauvignon some of the time. So it's nice to go to somewhere like Chile where the Sauvignon's so inherently different, you know, and it's still very fresh and very attractive. I think what makes New Zealand Sauvignon a little bit tricky sometimes is that those very, very driving herbal notes make it very hard to match with food.
Right, right.
Because a lot of the foods which... we kind of logically you'd match them with because of the flavor profile tend to actually have that kind of clash, things like asparagus,
so
that metallic or artichokes or whatever, you know. So I think the Sauvignon from Casablanca is very, very food friendly. That whole citrus thing, it goes very, very well with a much wider
range. A bit rounder
of
too, you know, the fruit's a little bit fuller in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you tend to get pretty nice body, pretty nice texture. Yeah. I mean, certainly what I work really hard on at Casa del Bosque is a lot of skin contact on the Sauvignons before we press. So this year, I kind of went a bit crazy and started doing 5 days on skins before pressing off.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing that, what you're doing is just extracting a lot of the flavor from the skins. I mean, you know, going back, looking at the grape, the berry, I mean, it's all of the flavors are pretty much contained within the skin. So by doing all of that extra time on skins, you're getting a much clearer sensation of the terroir coming through into the wines, which I think is a really interesting aspect of skin contact. And you also get a lot more mouthfeel. So I'm really trying to make Sauvignons which work really well with food, which just hang in there and you know, they can stand up to a wide, you know, quite intense dishes, if you like.
Yeah, and then you're right on the coast, you said, in near Valparaiso as well, which is probably a town or a city that our listeners are familiar with in terms of a point of reference for Chile. So those types of dishes that would go well with the Sauvignon Blanc, what are some of them that...
Ooh, that's a tricky one. I mean, Valparaiso, or Valpo as we call it in Chile, it's a port.
Yeah.
Historically, it's always been the most important port in Chile. And... It's a very eclectic, very funky city. I mean, when you're down, you didn't visit. Unfortunately, you have to come back and see it. But it's very bohemian. It was Pablo Neruda's favorite city, the famous Chilean poet, if you like. and it's just very eclectic, and it's also a fishing port, so there's a lot of seafood.
Yeah.
I think the seafood inherently does go very well with
what
we're doing in Casablanca generally. I mean, we make Chardonnay as well, and the Chardonnay, once again, tends to be very, very citric. They're not big, heavy, waxy Chardonnays. They're much lighter. They're much more vibrant, and they do go really well with seafood. I mean, I think probably if any of your listeners are going to come down to Chile and want to go and visit Valparaiso, I mean, the things they have to try are things like pico roco, which is frightening. I squealed like a girl the first time I ever saw
it. You have to try, but beware.
If anyone's seen Aliens, it looks very similar to, you know, the moment where it bursts out of the alien out of the chests of the infected, you know, crew members or whatever.
Oof.
It's a giant goosenecked barnacle.
Oh, lovely.
They're only found, the standard non-gigantic version, grow in the Mediterranean. They're not really widely eaten because they grow in quite tricky places. I think only in Portugal they really eat them.
Okay.
As part of like a normal kind
lots of
dish.
Garlic. Butter, something to make it go down a little easier.
Something, it's like a barnacle that kind of lunges out of its shell and grabs things that go past in the ocean. So it does look quite frightening, but very tasty.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of there's good oysters as well, mussels, and you know, the Chileans are very fond of their sea urchins as well, piure as they're called down there.
Love sea urchin.
They're very full on.
So in Valpo, you see then a range of different regions from Chile being represented on like wine lists, for instance, or does
I mean, Chileans traditionally are still much more inclined to drink red than white, regardless of what they're eating. I mean, it's one of those things that kind of drives me a little bit nutty in Chile. Is you know, you get people eating a lot of ceviche, which is a very classic dish in Chile. You know, I'm sure your listeners know what ceviche is. It's originally Peruvian, but very widely consumed in Chile as well. It's just, you know, raw seafood, which is marinated in lemon juice. And you still see people eating that with very heavy Cabernet Sauvignons from Colchagua and Maipo, which is a little bit difficult to understand, I think, if you're coming from outside of Chile. But it's, you know, it's what they're used to. So.
Sure.
So there's a lot of red wines too.
Okay. And then in addition to the Syrah that you're kind of taking some effort to plant, and are you planting more of that, or is it just at the moment what's under vine you're cultivating? And
well, I'm working on the owners with that now. I mean, we have 250 hectares in total planted, which is a pretty big vineyard. So, I mean, we're talking, what, about 600 acres? Half of that Sauvignon Blanc. So Sauvignon Blanc is a sort of focus in terms of, you know, varietal breakdown, if you like. We've got about 50 hectares of Pinot, about 50 hectares of Chard, and only about 20 hectares of Syrah.
Okay.
So Syrah for me is kind of like the rising star in Casablanca. It's really starting to take off, and people are certainly planting more. It's not an easy variety to grow because of what I was talking about before. It ripens right on the limit of what you can get away with. So there'll be some years, you know, where invariably you can't pull it off.
Right. So more wineries than just your own are experimenting with planting more then.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, there's Syrah planted throughout the valley, but where we are specifically, it is by far the coldest, if you like, corner of the valley. And it just makes it that much trickier to get it ripe. I mean, we're like, you know, if you look at Napa, like Carneros,
right
down the bottom of the valley, where they're much more affected by those fogs coming in.
Sure, yeah.
That's exactly our sort of situation. We, if you compare us to the other end of the valley, which is only about 10 miles away, so it's not that far off, but there's a two-week difference in between when we start picking Sauvignon and when they start picking at the other end of the valley, and that's just because of those fogs. We get the fog pretty much every day, whereas at the other end of the valley, that doesn't usually form in like the summer months. So we'll typically have, in January, February, our hottest months, maybe 2 hours less sunlight during the day, and so it's 2 hours in the morning up until maybe 10 in the morning. The fog breaks or lifts, and then it starts to heat up, but there's a lot less heat accumulation, and because we're so much close to the ocean as well, in the afternoons we get that really cool breeze rolling in off the Pacific. I mean, basically, I mean, a really important factor in Chile is there's a really cool, super cool current rolling up the coast of Chile called the Humboldt Current. Comes up directly from the Antarctic, and yeah, the water's incredibly cold. If you go for a dip, did you ever go for a dip when you're in Chile?
No, I didn't actually. We went down to the coast to Matanzas, which is that kind of famed windsurfing beach.
Yeah,
which looks beautiful, but I don't think, didn't go for a dip. No.
You're a smart girl.
The water was definitely inviting in terms of its looks, but it was still pretty cold.
No, it's cold year round. I mean, even in summer, you really don't get above 16 degrees Celsius. So that's probably about 58 Fahrenheit, maybe.
And that's as warm as it gets.
That's as warm as it gets. So you can pretty much.
So those surfers, those windsurfers are wearing some suits for sure.
Yeah, and I did once get in the water in Chile, but it just depressed me too much. You know, you're in there for 1 minute, and it's like regressing to pre-puberty. You know, it's not good for your morale as a man. You know.
Yeah, well, maybe after a morning like today, it would have been good, right? After a late night in New York.
I don't know what you're trying to get at there, Aaron. This kind of innuendo is just not on, all right?
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break and be back after words to speak a bit about Pinot Noir, which is also coming from Casas del Bosque in the Casablanca Valley, and you're listening to Unfiltered, and our guest today is Grant Phelps. Please stay tuned.
Following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Unfiltered. This is your host, Aaron Fitzpatrick, with my guest today, Grant Phelps of Casas del Bosque from the Casablanca Valley in Chile, who just arrived in New York yesterday to be here for the big launch of your wines in the New York market. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to be here.
So tomorrow there'll be an event at Puro Chile, which is the Chilean sort of wine boutique event space market that houses everything Chile and Puro Chile. And there'll be a reception with people able to speak to you and taste your wines and welcome them into the market here.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to have a fair few glasses of wine.
I sure think so, too. It starts at 6 o'clock. Not sure if there's any spaces available, but by the time this airs, we're going to be airing the show on Tuesday, the 14th, the day of the Wines of Chile tasting at Gotham Hall, which is a big annual fair Wines of Chile puts on every year, and you somehow make it to the event every year, a week after harvest. So
yeah, it's wicked. I mean, it's coming straight into New York with all that sleep deprivation, and then, you know, obviously doing what you do in New York.
Yeah.
More sleep deprivation.
I know.
It's going to get the better of me one of these days. Just hopefully not on this trip.
So we were talking a bit about Syrah, which is a increasingly popular grape that you're having success with in the Casablanca Valley, and there's also Pinot Noir that you do, and I just wanted to speak a little bit about that. I know the winery has been making some adjustments and introductions to further Pinot Noir. It is kind of the darling of the consumer basis, I think, for the past couple of years from all over the world. New Zealand especially has been seeing a growth of Pinot Noir, and then of course the Willamette and Napa, Carnero, Sonoma,
Russian River,
yeah, just all around town. And I sell it a lot on the floor, and I think that it just makes sense that in your cool climate, as we spoke about earlier, that Pinot Noir, even though it is finicky, certainly responds well to those cool climate nights and the longer hang time.
It does, yeah. I mean, Pinot's, it's a really difficult variety in general. I mean, it's famed amongst winemakers for being a pain in the ass, basically,
right,
to grow.
Right.
It's not very adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
So really with Pinot, the critical thing is planting on the right soils and with the right climate. I think, you know, I firmly believe Casablanca and certain other areas of Chile have just huge potential for Pinot. And we've got these really interesting soils. We've got really fantastic climate. I mean, where we are, it's very interesting because, you know, I talked earlier about the fact that there's no river running through the valley. The
yeah.
reason is in Chile you've got two mountain ranges, right? You've got the Andes and you've got the coastal mountain range. We're on the coastal side of the coastal mountain range, whereas pretty much all the other wine producing areas are between the two mountain ranges.
Okay.
That's why they're a lot hotter, because it kind of traps the hot air coming
right
that's sort of coming down off the Andes. Where we are, because we're on the coastal side of those coastal mountains, we've got much more influence from the Pacific. We
mm-hmm.
talked about the wind, the Humboldt Current, the fog. The other effect is because the glaciers never broke through the coastal mountain range in the last ice age, as they did everywhere else where wine is produced. Because of that, there's no river, but it also means that there's no new material that's been deposited on top of the really old original soils. I mean, these are soils that were formed under the ocean in the Cretaceous period and uplifted by plate tectonic movement. Where we are, we've got some of the oldest geological formations of their type in all of Chile. We're talking about magmatic extrusions. The hills on which the vineyards are actually planted are
mm-hmm.
upthrust directly from sort of the Earth's crust, if you like, by the movement of the magma.
Well, this well, is you've a, done this, your
this is a bit
research.
Too much, this is a bit
no.
too much information here.
Fascinating.
No, it's really cool because basically you dig down into the vineyard and you see these old, just really granitic soils,
mm-hmm.
which are very unusual in Chile, because Chile do have these soils everywhere, but they're usually covered in quite a deep layer of more like alluvial material that's been
okay.
brought down geologically much more recently from the Andes.
Yep.
And these sedimentary soils. Because in Casablanca we don't have these rivers or anything like that, the soils are very original where the root systems are of the vines.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I think if you are looking for it as a winemaker, you can really clearly just bring this amazing minerality into the wines. I mean, I think it comes through really, really clearly in the Sauvignon Blancs, this real salinity where we
cool.
are.
Yeah.
And it also comes through pretty clearly in the Pinot. I mean, Pinot is a variety which, if you plant on the wrong soils, just goes really badly.
Yeah.
But if you plant on the right soils, where there is a sense of terroir, it's one of those, the few varieties in the case of a red, which can bring it very, very clearly through into the final wine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's the really interesting thing. I mean, I think in a Sauvignon, you get a clear kind of saline character, and in the Pinots as well. So, you know, I'm pretty excited to be making Pinot off these really just wicked old soils. It's quite exciting, you know. Obviously,
definitely, yeah.
Most winemakers, we are kind of soil nerds, and you know, we get excited about this stuff.
Well, I agree with you. I think that Pinot is actually that much more attractive when you have those mineral notes in there, and that isn't just, you know, fruit or florality, but it really has that backbone of minerality. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
So we talk about Casas del Bosque, that translates to what exactly in English from Spanish?
Yeah.
It's the Valley of the Woods, or Houses of the Woods, right?
Yeah. Houses of the Woods,
houses of the forest.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in addition to, you know, the landscape that you've brilliantly described for us and put this picture in our heads, are there a lot of trees around as well?
Well, there used to be. We clear felled them to plant the vineyard.
Ah, I see. Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. That's not true. No, basically,
some of them you did, I'm sure.
Yeah, we did have to. I'm sure I wasn't there at the time. But basically, no. I mean, it's Casablanca's. There's no groundwater. It's always had kind of. There hasn't been a lot of agriculture there historically and until recently, and it was kind of high chaparral vegetation. So there was a lot of kind of like shrubbery,
mm-hmm.
if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of.
Yep.
I don't like using that word. It makes me think of Monty Python, right?
Okay.
Shrubbery. So, yeah, there was kind of like a lot of just small plants, basically, small trees, nothing really major.
Okay.
So, what we actually have, which is quite interesting, is we have this hill in the middle of the vineyard, which we have kind of a lookout up there where you can kind of hang out and drink wine if you come to visit the winery. And we have a really old tree there, which is called an espino, which is actually on the labels of all the bottles. It's one of these original little kind of stumpy trees.
Stumpy, yeah.
Yeah, but it's very, very old. We think it's about 500 years, which is very unusual to find one of these trees which is 500 years old. And so it's quite big now.
It's the big mascot.
It looks a little bit like the photo of the album, that U2 album, the Joshua tree.
Sure, yeah.
It's a little bit like that.
Okay.
The hill with the tree.
He's a good friend, though, watching over everything.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I mean, that's why we took it as the symbol for the winery on the labels, because of that. But yeah, I think Casas del Bosque is a bit of a misnomer if you translate it directly, because I don't think there was ever any big forest there.
Okay. And then one other question I had was regarding the gravity, which seems that a lot of winemakers, a couple which I've visited in Chile, are using gravity flow in terms of the actual press and whatnot. And is that something specific to your region that works well? Or
I think gravity is nice. I, as a winemaker, I try to use gravity. Gravity is my friend. I try to use it when I can.
Mm-hmm.
Gravity wasn't our friends with the earthquake, though. That was kind of an exception to the gravity being your friend rule. That was like gravity, all the wine on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Not good.
Not good.
No, but generally with gravity, I mean, I'm not a real purist in that. There's some winemakers who think pumps are bad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think pumps necessarily are bad. I think their pumps sometimes are great for a wine. Sometimes a wine is very, very closed and a little bit reduced, and just passing it through a pump, I'm talking about a pump which gently moves the wine, not a pump that thrashes it about. If you're careful with your pumps, I think pumps can actually be very, very positive. I don't think it's necessarily a very bad thing. I think the whole gravity thing in some instances is just a bit of marketing malarkey.
Right,
I think that's what it can often be. Sounds great. The press love it.
Uh-huh.
But whether it actually makes a difference to the wine, I think you kind of have to let it be a little bit cautious about that. I mean, it's like the whole hand-picking issue,
Right.
Wineries love bandying about the whole hand-picking thing. I think machine picking in some cases is far better.
Yeah, I guess it's a lot of these things have to be taken into context and not made on sort of a blanket statement level. Yeah.
I think people love to cling to these little things because, I think the consumer who doesn't know a lot about wine goes, "Oh, hand-picked, fantastic. Oak aged.
Yeah.
Gravity fed." I mean, it's really
the next new thing.
It's all about the wine at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
Is the wine good or is the wine not good?
And then one other aspect of marketing, which we spoke a little bit about during the break, is climate change and global warming and whether or not as a winemaker, and this may have been something I asked you two years ago, and I think that we've seen it in the press that much more in the past year, just in terms of whether or not you've seen harvest dates. I know that you're working in a new valley now, but harvest dates change based on, warmer weather, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's climate change, if you look at it very carefully as a climatic phenomenon, what it's doing is it's raising the average temperature globally.
Mm-hmm.
But what it's really going to do is produce very different weather patterns in different areas. Like wetter areas in general are going to become much wetter, dry areas are going to become much drier. So I think we've had actually two much cooler than average seasons the last 2 years
Have
in
you?
Chile.
Okay.
So harvest has been much later than normal.
Mm-hmm,
so you could kind of take that and go, oh, global warming's bollocks.
Right,
it's not. It's obviously, it's definitely a real phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had two kind of strangely cool years. We also had quite a slightly wetter year than normal this year, but during the harvest. But then in general, and most of the rainfall, almost all of the rainfall in Chile falls during winter. And we've had two very, very dry winters the last 2 years. So I think that's the real issue in Chile, is what global warming is going to do to rainfall.
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
Chile has always been fed basically by sort of irrigation projects coming from the Andes. I mean, these are things that were started up 300 years ago, digging these by hand, these canals to bring snowmelt down into the valleys to actually irrigate. If it weren't for that, Chile would basically be a desert, because the rain, it does rain a reasonable amount, but it all falls during 3 months of the year, during winter.
Right.
The other 9 months of the year, when all the plants are growing, if you didn't have these irrigation projects, there'd be no water to water your vines or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a couple of drier seasons, and so the aquifer is much lower, and so that's very difficult. I mean, It's tricky where we are. It's tricky everywhere in Chile right now. I mean, if it doesn't rain so much, then it snows less, so there's less of a reservoir, if you like, of water on the Andes to sustain us through the growing season. At the same time, vineyards plantings are increasing. There's a lot of big olive projects going down in Chile at the moment.
Yeah.
So there's all these new projects, and at the same time, water availability is going down. So that's going to be, we're going to get to some kind of crunch point at
some point. Right, yeah, sounds like that.
Well, I think in some respects it's actually very positive because it obliges us to become much more careful
about how
we use our water.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're becoming much more efficient with our irrigation now because of that. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. But we are going to get to a point where obviously we can't keep planting more vineyards because it's not going to be enough water anymore.
Hmm, interesting. Well, are there any other things that you'd like to talk about and close the show? I mean, we'd love to point our listeners to your website. I know are you Twittering yet? Last time I checked, you weren't.
I'm under huge amounts of pressure to Twitter, but I just don't have time.
Okay.
I do a little bit of Facebooking. That's about as far as I go. No, so I haven't gotten to that. I'm going to have to do it. But
going to break down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's no, I think it is interesting. You know, I think it's interesting if I put a comment on my Facebook page saying, hey, today we're blending, you know, the estate selection wine, you know, it's a top wine. You know, I'll get all these comments from people.
People get excited,
you know, hey, how's it looking? Da, 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 da. So I think, you know, people are interesting. But the whole Twitter thing, it's a bit full on.
Yeah, all right.
A bit too much information.
Well, what's your Facebook page then?
I'm just Grant.Phelps.
Grant.Phelps. And then the website for Casas Del Bosque is CASASDELBOSQUE.CL.
Right on.
All right. So there's a lot of information. It's a great website that really gives a full scope of what you guys are doing. So
there you go.
Yeah, that's it.
Just tell the listeners to come on down and visit the winery. We're open to tourists. We have a great restaurant. And come and visit Valparaiso as well. It's a beautiful city.
Cool. Well, thanks again for coming.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This story comes off of MarketWire. Totally Green enters the U.S. hotel market with Orca, O-R-C-A, Green Machine, installed at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston, Massachusetts. Totally Green Incorporated, a pioneer in organic food processing systems and compostable packaging alternatives, has installed its revolutionary Orca Green Machine at the Four Seasons Hotel in Boston. Four Seasons Hotels have implemented the Orca Green Machine to establish on-site composting of organic food waste generated by its restaurant and cuisine services. The organic composter saves the hotel tipping or disposal costs. The organic refuse produced by the hotel no longer needs to be hauled away. The Orca Green Machine composts up to 2,400 pounds of organic refuse per day into harmless, nutrient-rich gray water that can be safely put into the sanitary sewer system. The Four Seasons Hotel staff deposits any organic food waste generated throughout the hotel's guest rooms and restaurants into the composting machine. This aerobic compost process complements Four Seasons' environmental mission to support sustainability by reducing the amount of methane-producing organic material that they send to landfills. Well, kudos to the Four Seasons Hotel chain, because everybody could do that if they wanted to spend the money. I thought that was a really interesting story. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
HeritageRadioNetwork.com has its own architecture show dedicated to the built environment, hosted by Curtis B. Wayne. Check out a small clip of Burning Down the House.
So if we look at tall buildings and we talk about the wind blowing over them, we have all these different variants on, is it a horizontal rotor, like the big wind turbines that you see off of Aarhus in Denmark, I think it's where it is, and the local people are very proud of it. Or Falmouth, where the locals are not happy at all. Out west, there are enormous wind farms, but they're far from habitations. And so the low frequency sound that's generated by those turbines is not a problem. But what we don't want in terms of taking this notion, this notion of the future and making it beautiful and bright and clean and silent, is to create.
Want to hear more? Well, tune in live to Burning Down the House every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. or check out past episodes in our archive or subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat. The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be.